Hi. So we left off starting this, but I think we should do review and then kind of get a sense of what's known as the cosmological argument concerning God. Now remember the rules of the game. When we talk about God here, we're not talking about Jewish God. We're talking about
God in general,
a deity. Okay. So let's not think through the lens of Torah. Just stomp the idea of a deity.
God is there.
Okay, but let's assume I'm going to be biased. So I'll tell you that's the end game. Okay, we're not at the end game yet, right?
Well, if you're going to prove there's God, there might be, you might be proving that there's multiple gods, but there's
not. No, I'm just trying to say that Avraham Avinu in the Rambam's history of Avraham, he discovered the idea of a non-physical deity.
Right.
Okay, whether that's did that end up being in the Jewish version the same God that gave us the Torah? Yes, but we're not ready chronologically to get to that point.
Okay.
Right. Let's just talk about. Does it make sense to have a discussion about God? So we did Pascal's wager already, okay, which no one seems to like. So now let's talk about the cosmological argument, okay? I mentioned intelligent design last time, which
I mind Pascal's wager.
What?
Do we still need the Pascal's wager paper?
No.
Okay, good.
No.
You will never do that ever
again. Right. So we finished with Pascal's wager. So now let's focus on, what I want to focus on today is going to really be what's called the anthropic principle, okay? The anthropic principle is let's lay out the rules for today, okay? Today I want to focus on what the anthropic principle is. Next time we'll deal with questions on the anthropic principle as well as classic arguments to defend it, okay? So the objective here right now is, if you ask questions on the anthropic principle, I'm going to say that's a good question. And we're going to wait till next week to get into the arguments against it. First, I want to present how the anthropic principle is normally presented. What's the anthropic principle? Okay, very interesting idea. I forgot to bring my chart in. Well, I'll tell you right now. I forgot to bring my chart in, but what's really cool is this guy named Timothy Ferris, who's a physicist, has a chart in a book on astronomy that talks about it's the scale of the universe, okay? The observable universe in meters that we've discovered so far is 10 to the 26 meters. Count 10. How many zeros afterwards?
26.
Your brain can't think of that number. It's an impossible number. There's not even a number for it, okay? And by the way, that's only a fraction of what we actually see in the universe. He wrote that book, I think, in the
80s. There is a number for it?
No, there is.
Yeah.
I know, but I'm saying your brain can't conceive of such a number. 26 zeros doesn't fit into here, okay? And that's only a small part of the universe, okay? So the scale of the universe on the larger level is 10 to the 26 and beyond. On the smallest level is what?
It's
10 to the minus, I think it's like 18, something like that, which is really talking about
Planck.
Subatomic, well, oh, good. The what?
Planck.
Right. It's Planck.
Max
Planck.
Like German or something?
What? Yeah, he was, yeah.
Yes.
What? German, right. So that's which is the smallest measurement. But what is it in reference to normally? What's the smallest thing we've seen? Well, yeah, we can't see a quark. But it's probably subatomic particles. Okay? You can't see a quark. Well, at least we know we can't see a quark. Yes. I have a book at home, by the way, which has the first picture ever taken of an atom. Right. It's so cool. It's black. I think it was I don't know if it was iron. I think it was iron. Anyway, it's this white dot, which if you didn't know you're looking at an atom, you would think is
just a white dot,
right? It's so cool. It's like one of the first pictures ever of an atom.
Yeah,
okay.
It could just be a white dot.
No.
Just
right. But then that gets into trusting authority and history and experiences. Okay. So what's the anthropic principle? Knowing the universe is so massive. And again, when we say the universe is massive, it's hard for anyone here to appreciate it. Hopefully this Thursday, you guys are going down to Mitzpeh Rimon, right? Which gives you a very, like, it's funny. Like, I don't even know why the constellations are important anymore, but they used to have importance in our history. But right now, when you see a small amount of stars, which is basically a fraction of 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 a percentage of what lies in the universe, you realize it's very bizarre that what exists here on Earth, us, okay? So the anthropic principle is based on one simple assumption. Was the universe developed, okay, for the express purpose of being observed and understood by intelligent beings, or is it just a lucky break for the intelligent beings that they exist at all? Two roads you go down, okay? Not quite, but whatever. We'll get to that. That's another thing we'll get to, the matrix idea. But there's two possibilities.
Instead of trying to understand the size of the universe, why don't we just say it's infinite?
Because it can't be.
But it is.
It's not.
It isn't.
No, because it's physical.
Expanding,
that's
it's still
at least as far as what we know.
Yes.
Right.
Wait. So if it's constantly expanding, what's after the universe?
Language of that question is inapplicable. You can't talk about that. When I say not illegal, I'm saying, well, I'm not saying it's us to talk about, I'm saying there's no meaning to the word you're saying.
Wait, so why is it not illegal?
Because if something's always expanding, that means by definition there's an end to it. It's got to be spending to something.
There is no end to it.
There is.
It just keeps going.
No, but that doesn't mean there's an end to it. I'll give you an example. Can I do the following? Again, the analogy I try to use, which is the best way to explain it, is can I do, if I went like this, can I rip open the universe, right? Let's say I did that, what would I see behind it?
No, I don't know.
No, it's a nonsensical question, because there is nothing behind the universe, because the universe is the limit of our physical reality.
So to our physical reality,
it's the only reality we have is the physical reality. So what else is there to talk about other than the physical reality? That's something that's true, but that's something else.
Physical.
That's not scientific.
Conceptual reality isn't lying outside of physical reality.
Conceptual reality? Well, it depends on your whole body.
Not like physically outside. Like, oh, you reach the edge of the universe. Okay, great. Now you're in conceptual reality.
Right. That's true. Now, if you're like some of the guys in this yeshiva, if you believe in Plato's theory of ideas, then the question is there a metaphysical realm in the universe of ideas? But I would still argue that's within the universe. Don't ask me how. But I would still argue that's within the universe. Meaning, outside the universe, there's nothing to talk about. Okay. But we'll get into dark energy and dark matter down the road.
Ideas be in the universe?
Because they were created. When I say popular, what I mean is that a lot of people love talking about this when it comes to both defending religion, right, as well as attacking it. Meaning, and physicists, by the way, are actually pretty split on this. There are a lot of physicists who like the idea of the anthropic principle, and a lot of them who hate it. Because what does it ultimately mean? Again, you have two possibilities. Either you're going to say that and it comes down to one simple idea. Change one hydrogen atom in the universe, and what happens to humanity?
It
can't exist. Make it simple. I'll get into some specific, I'm going to bring this to a specific example. So to make it, he's correct. It's not the most accurate way to put it, but it's imagine for a second you have a puzzle, okay, of billions of pieces, okay? If you take one piece out of the puzzle, is it the same puzzle anymore?
Yes.
So those who are proponents of the No. Those who are proponents of the anthropic principle would say no. But they would say that can't be the puzzle.
I'm not really understanding what
it is the puzzle.
Okay, in other words, the anthropic principle means that everything in this universe is fine-tuned for one thing and one thing only.
Human beings.
Okay? Meaning, if the slightest thing were off in the universe, we couldn't exist.
That's not true.
What is that?
Yeah.
Try to bring out this principle. I'll show you an example. Go to this page here on page 121. The anthropic coincidences, okay? This is one of 11 examples he brings in this book. Paul Davies in his book has lots of examples. And these are the kind of examples that make you say things like, wow, that's interesting. That doesn't mean you have to hinge your belief on a God or not on this, but it's something to think about. This example is one of the easier ones, which is called the three alpha process, okay? You have to understand very little, I don't even take chemistry ever, you have to understand very little about chemistry to understand this idea, okay?
My page.
What? This page here, 121. Okay? 121. Oh, okay. Okay, and the first example, we traced up the building of the elements to the point where nuclei made up of four particles appeared. Okay, the only kind of nucleus with four particles that can exist is helium-4, which has two protons and two neutrons. So far, so good? Again, the only thing we know that can exist, okay, that has, that has four particles up to this point in time, right, is going to be helium-4.
Well, don't neutrons, you can have more.
No, we're going in order of the creation of the universe. Yeah. Okay, so let's go. Like, the universe is created. All you have is a lot of hydrogen and helium. Okay? Question's going to come up is, where did all the other elements come from? They certainly were not part of the Big Bang. In the Big Bang, you only basically had hydrogen. And that
even, why not? Even
what? You'll see why.
How do you say the world was created with the Big Bang?
Correct. I'm saying at the point where the first elements in the universe were hydrogen and helium. Yes. That's what comes up before this point.
Yeah, okay.
So now we have a universe. Right now in the universe, we have lots of hydrogen and helium. The question is, how do we get to carbon?
How do you get to Earth?
Forget Earth. That's more basic. Forget Earth. How do you get to carbon? What do you need carbon for? What do you need carbon for? For us. We're organic. You can't have, without carbon, you can't be us. Forget oxygen. How do we get to carbon? Okay? Watch. And this, by the way, is science at this point in time is accepted universally by physicists. Forget the coincidence part. Just how this happened is universally accepted. Okay? It'll freak you out when you hear...
I read this in one of the books that was...
So he says this. He says, making helium-4 is very easy, okay? In fact, a great deal of helium-4 is made in the Big Bang and is still made in stars, okay? However, the next step in the chain is exceedingly tricky. The problem stems from the fact that four particles, now listen to this, four particles prefer to be bound together as a helium-4 nucleus, okay? Again, when you have helium-4, the protons and neutrons want to stay with each other. They have no interest in dividing, okay? And he's writing in a very Baobab-ish way, but basically saying they like each other a lot, intimately. They don't want to split up, okay? Okay. He says helium-4 even has a special name of their own, alpha particles, okay, for historical reasons that we need not get into. Fine. One could say that particles in helium-4 nucleus form a kind of exclusive club. Now listen to this. If a fifth particle comes along and tries to join the club, it is rejected. So now, you have helium flying around. Let's say you have a proton. okay? And the proton says, I really like to join helium-4. Helium-4 is going to save the proton?
No.
You're not welcome here. No way to attach to us. Get out, okay? Okay. That is why there are no stable nuclei that contain 5 or 8 particles, okay?
Is that true?
Yes. It would immediately degrade. What? Boron, right. But that's a noble gas. Those are like the exceptions. Okay. So he says, that is why, then he says, they're the famous gaps at 5 and 8. Okay. What this means is that once helium 4 forms, it's hard to make anything larger. Okay. In other words, after making helium 4, the next rungs of the ladder seem to be missing. So again, the problems are this. Once you hit helium 4, what elements are going to come into existence? It sounds like that's it for billions of years. Except what happens, okay? When scientists first started thinking about how the elements formed, which is called nucleosynthesis, okay, they had a hard time understanding how any of the elements in nature larger than helium-4 got produced. How do you get from helium-4, for example, for us, it's going to be like carbon, as an example. How do you get past that point? Forget gold and silver. How do you get past that? Okay, hold on. How did nature accomplish the feat? The way it happened, and still happens, okay, is rather delicate. And the interiors are stars, and this is cool. All of us ultimately come from stars. When they say we come from stardust, that's actually true. We come from stars, okay? How? Watch this. In the interiors of stars, helium-4 nuclei are constantly bouncing into each other, but are unable to stick together. So remember, you have inside stars trillions of helium-4 that are, imagine just, picture in your head like a glass sphere. That's what I like to do. And inside that sphere, which we'll call a star, you have helium-4 bouncing like crazy back and forth, okay? What happens? Okay? Now, they don't stick together. However, they do remain together for a very brief interval of time, about 1/100,000,000th of a billionth of a second. Think about that for a second. 1/100,000,000th of a billionth of a second, which means what can happen? You slow the clock down to the point of 1/100,000,000th of a billionth of a second. There's a point where the two helium fours do what? They touch and don't quite separate. They don't attach to each other, but they do this. Bam. Now, again, 10 to the minus 17 seconds. How long is that?
Really
seemingly nothing, right? Okay, but it does happen.
Minuscule.
But that's not good enough, because that only gives us how much? 8. Okay?
Yeah.
It sometimes happens that in the fleeting moment when two helium-4 nuclei are joined, a third helium-4 comes along and hits them. Okay? Sometimes you know what happens, which is even rarer, is you'll have two helium-4s knocking to each other for that billionth of a second, and the third one comes along and does what?
Hits them.
Also hits them. So now you have three helium-4. What's it make it easy? Let's say three helium-4 hitting each other at the same time. Okay?
Is it hitting both?
Yeah. But this is what happened, though. Okay? So, you're right, but this is what happened. So it says that nature, in other words, takes a large double step to get past the missing rungs in the nucleosynthesis ladder. Once carbon nuclei are formed, it is clear climbing to make all the heavy elements. Once you have carbon, you can make everything else. Okay? Since helium-4 nuclei are also called alpha particles, this curious process where three of them collide at once is called the three-alpha process. As one can imagine, the three-alpha process does not happen very often, since the third alpha has to come along at just the right moment, just in the right 1/100,000,000th of a billionth of a second. In fact, when physicists first estimated how much carbon we produce in stars in this way, they found much less than actually exists in nature. This is baffling. Then he proceeds to explain how more of it was formed. Let me just give the main point. The main point is like this. The odds, again, this is the key to the anthropic principle. You know, I'm not telling you to buy into it or not. I'm just stating what it is. The odds of carbon being...
using this an ID.
What, intelligent design? That's not an anthropic principle. This is a subsection of that idea. Intelligent design is that the universe is so complex, someone must have made it. We're going to get back to that in a second. This is saying that the odds of carbon coming to existence are...
very...
obscenely low. Okay? Now...
why? I don't understand why.
Because, okay... what happens is helium four and
helium
four
doesn't collide with anything else.
Right, they don't attach to each other. Right. Okay, so when they do hit each other, sometimes, right, very rarely,
a third one will come in.
Right, now how often does that happen?
Not very, very slightly.
Extremely rarely. But when we say rarely, we don't mean like as rare as I don't know, like Shua taking a shower. That's pretty aggressive.
Nice.
Rather, we mean like universe-wise, obscenely rare. Okay, point like, whatever.
Is the math that you agreed upon with physicists and math?
Yes, but what you could say, but the argument against it's going to be, but in a billion years, or whatever, billions of years, okay.
Wait, so then the math doesn't matter.
And it definitely adds up to the probability. But that doesn't prove anything. That's the point I'm trying to make. Yeah, one second, hold on. Yeah. Matt, so what's it? What's it trying to bring out? I'll give you another example. Let's see if we can think, see from another example. Wait, another book.
Where's 1, 2, and 3? If we start at 4, where's 1, 2, and 3?
Mm. What do you mean? No, no, helium can helium exist in different forms.
Helium 4 is its most stable and common form.
So you could have helium 1, 2, and 3, but they disappear. Okay?
Helium 1.
As rare as
I'm sorry, right. It wouldn't be helium 1. Exactly. It would be hydrogen.
You could have helium 2.
Hydrogen. That's what helium is. I got helium is 2.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Right. Okay. Here's another example, okay? Take a look at the last page, okay, on the back.
Wait, hold on. Yeah. I mean, it seems like we're just skipping the whole part where he explains that it's not low odds.
No, he does.
He explains that it's, like, he explains how it works.
He explains, no, he explains why that but he's trying to show the fine-tuning point, which is that if it didn't happen this exact way, we never have carbon.
Right.
That's what
fine... Okay,
of course.
Well, right. Okay. How much of this carbon is being made... Yes. Excess in this 3-alpha process being used for life.
That's a good question.
There's a lot of carbon in the universe. We're not using all of it.
Relative to what?
Well, there's
relative
really
to the amount that humanity is using.
That's true, but relative to the universe itself?
Relative to the universe itself.
Correct.
Not.
Right.
But if you're going to take from this that, oh, wow, we've got this excess of carbon.
Agreed. Right, so good. So you're bringing up a good point. The response to that, again, without getting into the... That's for next week. Right. But the response to that for now is very simple. But this is one of dozens upon dozens upon dozens of... this type of issue, right? It's not just this. The question is now, when you create a philosophical theory, can you say, well, if there's enough examples, does it sway you?
Right.
So we're saying that carbon that carbon was formed solely for the, according to the anthropic principle, solely for the purpose of life.
I don't want to say solely, but I'm saying it seems like the direction the universe goes in is for our, according to the anthropic principle, is for us. It's going in that direction for us.
Wait, can you just say, if
for
it didn't go in that direction, then we wouldn't be here to say, oh, look at the universe.
Oh, so that's one of the counters into our principle. Okay, let's look at another example. Okay, look at the
for
last page.
Let's
say for intelligent, observant beings, humans. Yeah. Okay.
Is every unlikely statistical coincidence part of this? Like
only in the physical universe sense.
What about Nishima
right. Not like in the improbability of me surviving a car accident. Not,
yeah,
we're talking about like universe improbability.
On a universal scale.
Fred Hoyle do.
Okay, but look at the last page, okay? Last page, here's another example, okay? Look at the second paragraph. To give you a feeling for what I'm talking about, now again, this isn't a Jewish guy or anything like this, it's just a physicist writing. Okay, the ratio of the mass of a proton to that of the electron. Relax, guys. It's just water. All right. The ratio. The ratio. What? The ratio of the mass of a proton to that of an electron is 1. Blah 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 blah. Okay. You see that number there? Okay. Everyone see that? Okay. An utterly mundane number. Okay. So there's nothing important to the fact of the ratio of the mass of a proton to that of an electron. It just seems like a random number. Right? 1, 2, 3, 4. 5, 6, 7, or a little few of them are different, but anyway, whatever. It's the last page.
Yeah,
okay?
It's very light mass.
Whatever.
0. Something.
That's the mass of it, is the ratio of one to the other.
So then
in other words, your proton and electron.
And it divides out to make us the one that we know of, right? The one that I'm talking
1,800.
About.
No, no. It means if I showed like there's the mass of a proton and then the mass of electron, right? The what's bigger? A proton, right? It's been another ratio, meaning for every 1,836 point protons, I'd have an electron. Okay, fine. Which means protons are, in the subatomic world, are huge compared to electrons. Okay? The neutron to proton mass ratio is
roughly 1:1.
Right. Which looks equally uninspiring. Okay? Physically, it means that the proton has very nearly the same mass as a neutron, which, as we've already seen, is about 1.1% heavier. Okay? Is this important? Okay, so again, at this point, we see what seems to be not unimportant information. Turns out the ratio of a proton to an electron is, we'll call it what, 1,836 to 1, which is the proton is this big compared to an electron. When it comes to proton neutron, they happen to be the same. Does that matter?
No. I mean, depends.
Yes.
I mean, for what reason?
Of course. If I could choke you, I would.
Let's see.
Exists in a stable state.
Indeed, it is. Why is it important? And not just in determining the ratio of hydrogen to helium in the universe. The fact that the neutron's mass is coincidentally just a little bit more than the combined mass of the proton. Again, the fact that the neutron is off by, it's roughly 1:1, but there's a subtle difference, 0.0013 difference in the mass of a neutron to a proton. Why does that matter? Okay, I'll tell you why. It does, right? The fact that the neutron's mass is coincidentally just a little bit more than the combined mass of the proton electron neutrino is what enables free neutrons to decay. If the neutron were very If the neutron were very, very, even slightly lighter, it would not decay without an energy input of some sort. If neutron were lighter still, yet only by a fraction of 1%, it would have less mass than the proton, and the tables would be turned. Isolated protons rather than neutrons would be unstable, then protons would decay into neutrons and positrons with disastrous consequences for life, because without protons, there could be no atoms and no chemistry. So again, similar argument. You have like these weird things in the universe, right? You have this idea that the smallest difference between a proton and a neutron, which to us would seem insignificant, when you say one, like you said before, you walk right into that quote-unquote trap, that's a one-to-one ratio. It's not one-to-one. That point, blah, 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 1% difference is such a huge difference that if it weren't for that, what would happen to everything?
It would decay.
No humanity. Okay, so again, the anthropic principle is built on the concept of, when we look at nature, and again, just what it's built on. Whether you agree with it or not, it's a separate question. It's defining what the theory is. It's built on a certain premise, which is that the universe is built in a manner where the slightest alteration in many areas, not everyone, many areas, would mean what? Would spell for humanity. There could be no humanity. Okay? That's what it rests on. Okay?
I thought all elements had a root around K. I think you were wrong.
That's a different issue.
But that's, isn't that what we were just saying about the little bit extra? If it was any more, it would start decaying?
No. Then protons will be the ones that decay, not neutrons. The protons decay? Protons are pretty cool, because a proton...
Proton gives the identity.
Protons never decay. At least as far as we know about them. They're supposed to, but we never actually... It takes, I think, longer than the life of the universe for protons to decay, which I know makes no sense, but they don't, right? So what we're supposed to say is, if you're religious, Baruch Hashem for that. Because they should.
So wait,
it's built into their nature. They should. They just don't. They haven't. Doesn't mean they won't.
They don't, though.
But they haven't.
Radioactive isotopes.
Science actually undergone a bit of a facelift, okay? It's gotten a little more, I'd say, complex than how the Rambam describes it. So if you look over here, it's also very well, it's very well written, whether or not you agree with it or not. Page 69 in the packet, which I think is the second page, okay? Comparing the various statements quoted in the previous section, one can see that there are really two versions of the design argument, okay? One of them, which I shall call the cosmic design argument, is based on the order exhibited by the cosmos as a whole. Now, it's interesting, this guy's not Jewish, but he is Catholic. And he quotes Jeremiah, okay?
They all love Jeremiah.
I know. They love him, okay? It's interesting, okay?
They love him and prove Yashka.
I know.
They love...
Anyway, so one area of cosmic design has to do with the structure of the universe itself. So a lot of people focus on the perfection of the universe, excluding biology. Okay, and that's an important point. A lot of times in cosmological arguments, there's a cosmic design argument, which is that look at how perfect the universe as a whole is and how it's structured so perfectly, and someone must have brought it into existence. Versus the other one, which is more interesting, which I find very interesting, which is if you look at the end there, and these examples Macaulay was making, what I shall call the biological design argument.
You find this one more interesting?
Well, it's interesting to think about this as branching off of cosmic design. So I'll show you why. Doesn't even I agree with it. It's just an interesting argument. I never heard it put this way before. Before this, I always thought that there's one intelligence on argument, but to slice off organic structures that exist on Earth from cosmic design is an interesting approach. Okay, so if you look at it, he says like this. He says, closely related distinction between cosmic and biological versions of design argument is a basic ambiguity in the meaning of the word structure. Okay, this is very important. There are two, this paragraph here. Yeah. There are two really quite different kinds of structure. On the one end, there's the kind that comes to mind when we hear the words regularity, pattern, symmetry, and order. Okay, it's describable by mathematical rules. Okay, this is the kind of structure one sees, for example, decorative patterns. So again, our brains, it's unclear why, but our brains are trained to appreciate symmetry and structure. So, for example, when you see a lot of triangles, let's say geometry. When I see a lot of triangles next to each other, what do you extrapolate from that? You see a design, right? Design of triangles together. There's nothing wrong with saying that. Okay. That's called, what he calls it is symmetric structure. We see it, for instance, in music, okay? When you hear music, when you hear, let's say, a chorus over and over again, right? You have lyric, and then, you know, then what they repeat, lyric, repeat. What your brain is telling you is what? Symmetry. That's why, for those who appreciate classical music, when the first dissonant composers came about, what would they do? They have like the anti-Beethoven. When you listen to it, it sounds like, or like jazz, which I happen to like. Jazz is chaotic. But jazz is chaotic. You know why? Jazz has no...
It doesn't have order.
It's free.
Oh, which means there's no symmetry, which
is
what happened...
It's free within a structure.
So jazz, like aficionados who, you know, do this, like, meh, they say, no, there's really order there. You just can't hear it. But to the untrained ear, jazz sounds like chaos. Why? Because there's nothing repetitive about it. But if you listen, for instance, if you listen to Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, one of the most amazing things that he did, which is brilliant, was each movement has its own theme in it, which has repetitive in it. But in the fourth movement, you know what he does before that part? In the fourth movement, he takes little bits of each movement and puts it in the fourth movement. So he repeats the movements themselves in the fourth movement. Why am I bringing that about? Because we're attracted to symmetry. It's in our nature. We like symmetry. We see it as an important thing. In dentistry, just as an example, we're trained to see symmetry. We look at a person's two front teeth. It's so difficult to match one color to the other on front teeth versus back teeth. Why? Because they're right next to each other. Experiment on yourself. You'll see constantly that we're attracted to symmetry. Okay.
You just said how looking at your fronts, you can't tell by the molars.
No, molars are easier to match each other than front teeth.
Okay.
But it's only running out of time. But there's another kind of structure, okay, which we find in living things and which I will therefore call organic structure. Webster's Dictionary defines an organism this way, a complex structure of interdependent and subordinate elements whose relations and properties are largely determined by their function of the whole. Note that organisms are inherently complex. Even a bacterium, the simplest kind of living thing, is, according to molecular biologists, an enormously complicated structure. By some reckonings, it would take as great a quantity of information as there is in the Encyclopedia Britannica to describe all the parts of a bacterium and how they are put together. And multicell creatures, of course, are vastly more complicated still. So there's another kind of structure he wants to propose, which is a structure in what? In organic beings and things that were created, in quotes, okay? No. There's another kind of structure. One kind of structure is mathematical structure, geometric structure. But there's another kind of structure, which is very interesting, the structure of organisms, okay? Meaning, what he's trying to say is like this. There's a big jump to go from the structure of the universe, which is, let's say, I'll give you an example. Like, let's say, like, the shape of galaxies, okay? What shape do galaxies have? Many of them.
Spiral,
okay? Why? Why is it that way? We don't know.
Gravity.
Oh, that's true, gravity, but why did it have to be that way? There's no answer for that, okay?
You're asking about why things are the way they are.
Right, which we can't answer, right? But it does seem to be interesting to say that what happens, these things seem to work out in a very orderly way. In fact, there's one physicist who's challenged the very idea of why we insist there have to be laws of nature, right? We believe there are laws of nature, right? Why? Why are our minds attracted to an idea of laws of nature? Why don't we say that it's just coincidences? Why do we think there have to be laws? Hold on.
Let me finish. That's
something different, okay? But now, when it comes to what? When it comes to organisms, there's a whole different kind of complexity. Why? Because how do you jump from, let's say, atoms, right? I'll put in more medical terms, okay? Take like your heart, okay? Your heart's comprised of
atoms,
cells. No, that's not go that far. Cells. Those cells are comprised of subcellular components, which themselves are comprised of
atoms.
So you got something very strange. You have these atoms that for some reason somehow bond together to do what?
Form
molecules, and they do what? Form subcellular components. But all of a sudden, the subcellular components, you know what they do? Things. They
work,
do stuff.
They function.
Right. And then you have cells. And then cells, for some reason, heart cells do what? They gather together and do heart cell things. So the question is why? And you can't say evolution is not an answer. Evolution is just describes what? The process. But doesn't describe what?
Why it doesn't.
The fact that no evolutionary anthropologist can explain the leap from atoms to function. Correct.
Okay.
God.
That's